Hello everyone, welcome to the first podcast by Mesothelioma Guide. Our first episode ever will be with Dr. Chanel Bhagwandan, who is the medical director for the Gastrointestinal Surgical Oncology Program at Jupiter Medical Center. It's an excellent, in-depth, and informative conversation about his career so far in mesothelioma treatment, how he communicates with patients, how he became a peritoneal mesothelioma specialist, and his feelings on mesothelioma treatment. We hope you enjoy the podcast. And if you have any feedback or questions at all, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Or if you're just looking for treatment connections or legal help, you can contact our patient advocate and registered nurse, Jenna Campagna, at Jenna, that's J-E-N-N-A, at mesotheliomaguide.com. Here with Dr. Chanel Bhagwandan, the medical director for the Gastrointestinal Surgical Oncology Program at Jupiter Medical Center, and he's faculty at Mount Sinai in New York City as an assistant professor within the Division of Surgical Oncology. Dr. Bhagwandan, congratulations. You're actually the first guest we've ever had on for the podcast, so this is pretty awesome. Thank you for doing this, though.
I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and discuss about what I do and talk to patients.
Absolutely. So just give people who are listening a little bit of an overrun for what you do. Peritoneal mesothelioma is one of your specialties and one of your focuses, and you do have a lot of experience using HIPEC and cytoreduction for peritoneal mesothelioma for treating it. But just your education, you know, it's pretty extensive background within this field. I know you went to Lake Erie. And I'm going to try and pronounce this as best as I can, but you can correct me, Lake Erie College of Osteopathic Medicine. I know you did a residency at University of Illinois and then a fellowship in Mount Sinai, certified on the American Board of Surgery. And you were in the news, this is interesting for me, in the news talking about HIPEC on TV after that actual treatment and that surgery, or that, I guess that treatment, was featured on The Good Doctor on the TV show, correct?
Exactly. So it's definitely, you know, we're always learning new things every day. But, you know, one of the things, especially with awareness for certain treatments, is that sometimes they're not always available. So I was happy to be a part of that, you know, that expose and bringing light to the fact that not only is there a treatment for peritoneal meso, but certainly that it sort of caught nationwide attention on The Good Doctor, the TV show. And we had an opportunity to talk about what we do and also discuss with a patient that was previously treated with the cytoreductive surgery plus HIPEC.
Do you watch, or did you before this appeared on The Good Doctor, did you ever watch The Good Doctor? I mean, were you an avid viewer, or is this kind of something that kind of took you by surprise, I guess, or you didn't really know much about the show? I mean, I think I've heard of it just in passing, but I didn't know if you watch it a lot.
I guess my position is I probably don't get a lot of time to watch a lot of TV, but I was aware of the show before, and you know, certainly we were able to really get a good introduction to it with a lot of their medical expertise and people that had been you know, really talking about breakthrough treatments. And I think that's one of a good thing about the show is that they're looking for new opportunities for treatment and ways to treat. So certainly you know, really drew a lot of attention, for sure.
Last question before we actually get into meso. I remember I used to watch House from way back when, like a decade and a half ago. I mean, and I just always imagined that show definitely kind of dramatized, you know, treatment and specific diseases and kind of how it works. And I haven't seen The Good Doctor. Do you feel that's the case? I mean, do you feel like it's kind of... I mean, it's Hollywood, right? Or it's dramatized is, I guess, the perfect word for it. That it's a little bit, exactly. It's made a little bit more, a little more gripping, I guess, for television, but this is not really a good representation of what it actually is like to have this disease sometimes and have these meetings. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes it's hard. Reality almost sometimes doesn't capture. It's funny, in this day of television and whatnot, it seems like a lot more is geared towards reality, but in actuality, it's really a lot of drama that comes along with it. And, you know, especially when it comes to cancer and what we do, you know, sometimes it is a tough thing to discuss. And, you know, in that context, TV certainly plays a role in, like you said, you know, giving it a little bit of a drama and flair to it. But, you know, it's I guess it's what self-taper, so to speak.
Exactly. Going into your education and then eventually your career, how did you become a peritoneal mesothelioma specialist? At what point in, like, whether you're at Lake Erie, whether it's residency, whether it's fellowship, like, at what point did that kind of click for you that you're gonna be specializing in oncology and in diseases that would be metastasize or relate to the peritoneum and peritoneal cavity?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is, certainly why I chose to do what I did, which is surgical oncology or cancer surgery, is helping patients that have advanced disease. But, where I went to residency at the University of Illinois at Chicago, Dr. George Salty, who's also an expert in peritoneal carcinomatosis and mesothelioma, I got introduced to HIPEC there as part of my residency. And HIPEC is not one of those things that's available everywhere. So I had the luck, I'll say, of being introduced to it, being introduced to patients that had advanced disease and needed a very specialized treatment. And in that, I was able to certainly take advantage and learn more about the techniques. And ironically, I went to Mount Sinai for fellowship, for my surgical oncology fellowship, where I trained under Dr. Daniel Labo. And he actually started the HIPEC program at Mount Sinai around 2006. So it's also him, Dr. Sarpel, Dr. Spiros Heotis. So I had at this point, a whole team, and Sinai is actually one of the largest centers in New York City that really does HIPEC. So we got to see a lot of patients. And in that, especially with regards to the training, it's sort of the same thing. Not all surgical oncology fellows graduate with the experience of being able to treat peritoneal mesothelioma. And it was really a good opportunity for me to sort of pioneer that. So with that, I ended up coming down to Florida. And, as a result of that, we were really able to establish a peritoneal surface malignancy program down here to treat patients with peritoneal mesothelioma so that they didn't have to travel, far and wide to get this treatment, let alone even know that it's available.
Yeah, especially people who live in Florida, when they don't have something close, they have to travel far no matter what. I mean, it's kind of isolated. So if I know we've mentioned HIPEC and I've mentioned cytoreduction surgery a couple times, just for the people who are listening, for someone who may have mesothelioma, who may have peritoneal meso, and just recently was diagnosed, if we could just explain what HIPEC is. I mean, it's heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy. But like just what that relationship is with surgery and how it works, if you could kind of just give like the, I guess the seventh grade version, or if you're explaining it to a seventh grader, everyone kind of says that, but like how you would explain it to a patient so that we can kind of have that summary.
Mesothelioma in itself is a rare cancer. It forms where I treat it is primarily in what's called the peritoneum or the abdominal cavity. And it basically develops on a thin layer that lines our organs or the inside of the abdominal wall. It covers our stomach and all of our other organs. And as a result of that, patients can develop essentially a cancer that can sort of be widespread, involve the lining of the abdomen as well as other organs, and spread unnoticed until you start to develop symptoms. Usually, the beginning symptoms of peritoneal meso, they can include abdominal distension, bloating, pain, swelling, tenderness around the abdomen. It can even affect your bowels, such as constipation, diarrhea, or completely encase the bowels so that patients become obstructed, or they start to develop obstructive symptoms such as nausea, vomiting, and whatnot. Peritoneal meso, it's again a rare type of cancer. There is a link primarily with asbestos or ingesting asbestos fibers. The best treatment afforded is primarily surgery and chemotherapy. And the chemotherapy is pretty specific to the way that it's delivered, is that normally, when you think of chemotherapy going through the veins throughout the whole body, HIPEC or the hyperthermic chemotherapy is delivered into the abdomen. So it directly comes in contact with the abdominal lining and all the organ surfaces that are affected with cancer. So that's sort of a quick, you know, survey of how we treat it. But that's the rationale, is that sometimes the systemic chemotherapy, the one that goes through the IV, just can't reach these tumors and this cancer. And as a result of that, we go to the operating room, we remove the bigger, bulkier tumors that we can see with the naked eye with surgery. And that's what's called the cytoreductive surgery, or debulking, because you're basically getting rid of a lot of the larger tumors. And any sort of microscopic disease that would cause this cancer to come back is what the chemotherapy is primarily for. It's delivered, it's heated, and it has been shown certainly to improve survival with this. Because as you can imagine, if this cancer is in the abdomen and it continues to persist, grow, it ultimately will lead to death. And as a result of that, it you know, obstructs the bowels, it affects the ability to absorb food and even digest things.
Two questions. One, and both of them you may not be very smart questions, but just as someone who's learning more about mesothelioma every day and mesothelioma treatment, in HIPEC, again, like you said, it's chemotherapy that is injected directly into the abdomen versus an IV. Directing it or inserting it, I'm sorry, directly into the abdomen, or administering it directly into the abdomen, does that have, I mean, is there less likely of a chance that it's going to have a negative effect on healthy blood cells versus?
That's actually a very, you know, an excellent question. And it sort of speaks to how we're able to deliver such high doses of chemotherapy into the belly without really having to worry about, you know, its effect on the rest of the body. The chemotherapy, the interesting thing about the peritoneum, or the peritoneal layer, or that abdominal lining, is that it limits sort of the transfer of drugs and things like that, medication, certain medications, out of the abdomen into our circulation to affect healthy cells. So really, when we deliver it, it's primarily concentrated in the area where the cancer is, and it almost becomes what we would call a regional therapy. So it's focused just on that area. And as a result of that, you can treat with very high doses of chemotherapy in the abdomen and avoid sort of this chemotherapy circulating throughout the body with all of the anticipated negative side effects that you do with traditional chemotherapy.
Awesome. Thank you for explaining that. And you also mentioned that peritoneal meso involves the ingestion of asbestos. That's one of the primary, if not the primary reason or primary cause. And you can also inhale asbestos. But I mean, is there a link between inhaling asbestos to pleural meso and ingesting to peritoneal? And if so, what's the biological process that leads to ingesting asbestos, the fibers just going to your peritoneum versus inhaling it going in through your nose, going into your pleural? Like, is there some sort of process and link there that just kind of naturally happens?
There are a number of theories. I'll say that we don't fully know.
Okay.
You know, how the asbestos fibers ultimately cause malignant peritoneal meso. You know, as far as how they might reach the abdomen and result in cancer, it could be anything from swallowing the fibers. They travel through the digestive tract, and by way of that, they access the peritoneum. Certainly, you can inhale the asbestos fibers, and as a result of that, we have a very intricate network of lymphatics, and asbestos fibers can travel by way of lymphatics to reach the peritoneum. But again, what we do know about asbestos is that it is damaging to our cells. It does damage our DNA, so that they can't heal, and as a result of that, that's what leads to the development of cancer itself. So once those cells, the asbestos then becomes irritating, let's say, to the cells in the peritoneum, they become very thickened. We start to develop fluid in the abdomen. That's what leads to distension. And over time, the thickening sort of leads to more and more tumors that begin to form on the peritoneum. And as a result of that, that's what contributes to these cancers sort of overtaking and what we call caking. If you think of layering a cake or smothering it, all of our organs sort of become very saturated with these tumors as a result of that.
Has HIPEC changed how, I'm trying to think of the word, has it changed how invasive surgeons and surgeries are for patients? Like, has it made surgery just naturally less invasive? Because theoretically, right? I mean, peritoneal meso, I mean, mesothelioma tumors are like microscopic. There are so many of them that it's so difficult sometimes to locate all of them. So a lot of, I mean, in theory, the surgery would take longer or it would be more invasive to try and make sure that you have removed as many as possible. But HIPEC, again, in theory, would be able to, it's chemo inserted right into the area that you're trying to attack to remove the cancer cells. So does that make surgery, like naturally, is surgery just less invasive and less of a risk for patients?
I would say, it is a very invasive operation because certainly, whereas let's say you're going into the abdomen to remove a colon cancer, you're focused specifically on the colon, whereas peritoneal mesothelioma has no limits, it has no bounds. It affects everything from the colon to the stomach to the liver, or it can. And in that context, the surgery to treat it is all dependent on how involved, aggressive, or invasive that disease is, meaning how it's spread throughout the abdomen. But as far as advances in the way that we've evolved with regards to HIPEC, what we have learned is how to select the appropriate patients for surgery. So we know that there are certain patients that probably won't benefit from having an invasive operation like that. Because there is such a higher likelihood of leaving cancer behind, which really wouldn't serve any benefit. The goal of the surgery is to get what's called an optimal site reduction or remove all, if most, of the disease. With regards to how we select patients, we use what's called a peritoneal carcinomatosis index. That gives us a score. And it basically breaks down the abdomen into quadrants that allows us to calculate a score and figure out what really is the appropriate amount of disease, let's say, that correlates with improving survival. At the same time, we know, we have some idea with regards to what chemotherapy drugs are going to be responsive, meaning the chemotherapy that we deliver into the abdomen, what type of chemotherapy agents are going to be more responsive to use in a patient with peritoneal meso. So, it really is all dependent on how much disease there is to minimize a lot of the complications that can come with a major operation like this.
And you mentioned peritoneal cancer index. It's 0 to 3 for 13 quadrants. Is that correct? Or is there a different system that I know that might not be the only system that is used, but that's the one I've found.
Correct. So
Okay.
it's primarily, you divide the abdomen into 13 regions, and essentially the number that's assigned to each region is on a score of 1 to 3 based upon the amount of tumor that's in that area.
And that's a way to stage, just in the same way that pleural mesothelioma is staged 1 to 4. It can be a way to stage, because like you said, it's a way to kind of determine patient selection for surgery, whether or not this is going to benefit them, whether or not it is not going to benefit them, like just like you said, like you
Then
summarized.
you can come up with a maximum score of 39 versus, someone that has a score, let's say 10, 12. The correlation there is that a lower index score means that the patient would likely qualify for surgery, whereas a higher index score means that the cancer has spread, it's more advanced and it limits what you can do surgically to remove it. And in terms of the research out there and advances that we've made looking at patients that benefit from this procedure, traditionally, if you have a score that's higher than 20, usually the patient won't respond well to surgery. It usually means that they have more disease than really can, be affected by a surgery without all the associated risks.
Do you or do you know of uses where HIPEC is more for a palliative purpose and it's not used in combination with cytoreduction? So it's not a patient who's eligible for surgery. It's just HIPEC to relieve pain, to try and manage the tumor growth, the tumor's growth, and try and manage its quality of life, more or less.
So the thing about the HIPEC is that it really will only penetrate once it's heated up to about 2 millimeters depth. So if you have big bulky tumors, essentially you're not going to get much of a response by, you know, having the chemo come in contact with it. That's why the surgery plays a role. But as far as palliative treatment options, one thing that the chemotherapy can do is that, or that it has been studied in the context of doing, is that it can blunt the amount of fluid that's produced by the peritoneum. So a lot of patients, when they present with peritoneal meso, usually the first thing is, again, bloating. Their abdomen is so distended to a point where they're, you know, man or woman, 9 months pregnant, and they have to require multiple drainage procedures just because, as you can imagine, as the abdomen continues to swell, it affects all of our organs. It compresses our blood vessels. It limits our ability to take deep breaths, and patients ultimately become very, very symptomatic. So as far as symptoms where you can't necessarily get a successful treatment out of it, to avoid the role for going to have multiple drainage procedures, meaning that you're taking out liters and liters of fluid, cancer fluid, out of the abdomen, only to have it come back every week, sometimes the chemotherapy has been used in that context to, again, sort of blunt the peritoneum so that those cells react in such a way that they slow down on the amount of fluid. Again, it's particular to certain types of cancers, but usually it would really only be used in that context of, or at least the palliative treatment option, to slow down or resolve some of the fluid. But I would say there's probably more of a, or less of a role with regards to just using the chemotherapy in that context, because especially if there's big bulky tumors, again, they're likely not going to respond.
Okay. What questions do patients ask you the most?
So most patients, I mean, a lot of patients, I'll say the majority of patients that I see at the time that they finally meet me for a surgery like this, usually they're too late to qualify for a surgery, meaning that the disease is too advanced. That's the primary question. Am I a candidate for surgery? And again, it really is going through the imaging, you know, going through their symptomatology. If at some point they weren't eligible for surgery and they've gotten some form of systemic chemotherapy, because that would be the alternative treatment option, that they get chemotherapy through the IV, you know, and it's really looking for that response to the chemotherapy alone. So, you know, some patients that will come at that point, the primary, you know, question is, am I a candidate for this treatment? And unfortunately, sometimes you can't tell just by looking at the imaging. And what it requires is something called a diagnostic laparoscopy, where we put a camera inside of the belly to actually look around, calculate that peritoneal carcinomatosis index, the PCI score, and really ascertain whether or not that patient is the appropriate candidate. So it is a little bit of a, you know, further diagnostic workup. As far as that, you know, I would say that another question is, you know, certainly pertaining to survival. So if you're going to go through this big operation, et cetera, and you want to make sure that obviously the treatment is better, or at least is going to improve survival, it's not worse than the disease, and it's not going to result in an unfortunate outcome, you know, especially having to have surgery to go ahead with this. So, you know, I would say that with regards to overall 5-year survival, patients, about 50% of patients are still alive after a procedure like this, whereas alternatively with chemotherapy alone, it can be rather advanced, and some patients will actually succumb to the disease within 6 to 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
There are also many different, you know, cell types related to peritoneal meso. You know, some patients are treated in the context of, you know, what would be used typically for ovarian cancer, because sometimes they fall in that realm, even though it isn't ovarian cancer.
Well, and there's also a link between, I mean, people who have mesothelioma, I got to word this correctly. Hold on. There is a link between mesothelioma and ovarian cancer, in that if you have mesothelioma, you also are more at risk of having ovarian cancer, and vice versa. I mean, there are studies for that. So yeah, I'm not trying to cut you off. I read that recently, wanted to point it out, wanted to sound smart, but
so yeah, exactly. So we do see some patients that, Certainly if they have a diagnosis, because not only ovarian cancer presents very similarly, and in patients that obviously still have their ovaries, that's a very real consideration, is determining and differentiating whether or not this is consistent with a primary peritoneal cancer, or if it's actually coming from the ovaries. The reason being is that sometimes the strategy with regards to chemotherapy versus upfront surgery changes, and it really is that rationale of sort of dissecting it a little bit. One of the benefits is that there's, you know, recent randomized data that has shown that, you know, ovarian cancer as well, those patients have a benefit with regards to undergoing cytoreductive surgery and HIPEC if they have advanced disease similar to how most of the primary peritoneal cancers present.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in that context, again, everything has to sort of be, laid out, looking certainly for genetic predispositions to certain cancers that may overlap and, you know, making sure we have the appropriate and effective treatment.
When you're communicating with a patient, how do you balance between giving them the info that they need, which, again, it could be that they are not a surgical candidate, or it could be that, you know, the life expectancy for this disease at with this score or is not great, versus being sensitive, because it may be different every time, I'm not sure, and is that something that, I mean, it can't be easy to deliver and discuss negative news, but you also have to. So how do
right,
you balance
absolutely.
That?
I think a lot of that is, you can't forget that's a very real person in front of you, and that's part of the reason I went into, you know, what I do right now, is because, ultimately at the end of the day, we love our patients, we like helping our patients. There are good days, there are bad days, et cetera. You're dealing with someone that, or rather you're dealing with a diagnosis that someone is still trying to digest. They're still trying to process. And it would be very, insensitive to just ignore that and move forward with recommendations. At the same time, I think, you know, some patients are fortunate to have their families involved, and, you know, sometimes that's where a lot of the questions come from, because, you know, patients don't necessarily know what the next step is, how to ask what the next step is, et cetera. So my job is to make sure that they have all the appropriate options with regards to treatment and try to anticipate or answer those questions that I think they would want to ask mm-hmm. in a situation like that. It's a very tough diagnosis to know that you have an advanced cancer, that there may be limited treatment options. Nonetheless, so I think that is really a little bit of the balancing act. And, you know, at the end of the day, patients ultimately want to know the truth, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important with regards to quality of life, figuring out goals of care, all of those things, the more accurate information rather than misinformation that we can provide up front as physicians really helps to bring patients into their, or involve them in their own care, so that they are a real part of the treatment team, as opposed to just being prescribed a treatment or talked to. They participate ultimately, and they ask appropriate questions when they're given that opportunity, to really sort through, is this really what I want to do next? Yes, that is a treatment option, but is this what appeals to me? And I think being a good listener and, you know, giving patients the opportunity, spending time with patients, and certainly going through the algorithm is important. You know, a lot of patients will, before they even come to the diagnosis, may have, for lack of a better word, some baggage that they're carrying into a consultation, be it misdiagnosis or delayed diagnosis. That's a very real possibility. So, you know, this is a rare cancer, and sometimes it is tough to come to a conclusion. So I think it is important to take the time to address any sort of misconceptions, notions, or anything that, you know, patients may have before going forward, because ultimately that may cause, you know, future, whatever future treatment options or even responses as well as their expectations going forward.
It seems like, and this, I'll let you go in a little bit. I have like one question, but it seems like working with people and like communicating and again, delivering that hard, that difficult news, but being honest, that is in many ways the toughest part of the job in multiple ways. One, because it's emotionally tough. And two, because like, yeah, the science can change. Science can evolve. You can learn new stuff. But for the most part, you know, as the peritoneal mesothelioma specialist, you are an expert and you know your way around this disease. But working with people, because there's so many different personalities that are going to come through your door, there's so many different types of families, so many different backgrounds, so many different thought processes and brains that are all wired a different way, that, you know, that's a very fluid aspect to your job. I mean, is that it? Would you agree that that is in many ways the toughest part, and that it's also the part that you probably learn the most about yourself, the job itself? I mean, again, it's not like you can perfect that aspect because everyone's so different.
Exactly. I think you touched on a very, very important point for a lot of us, just the human nature of it. And, you know, I probably learn more about myself from my patients. And it's not anything that they directly say to me. It's just being in those situations, going through that with them. The other thing I'll say is that it's important to have a team. You know, when you're diagnosed with this, you know, peritoneal mesothelioma, and it's important for me to have a team, because certainly the burden of everything can be overwhelming. But, you know, with regards to having a very rare diagnosis, you want to make sure that you have multiple experts, multiple opinions, because cancer doesn't always read the book. And so it's important to make sure that, you know, sometimes you do have to think out of the box. And that's really where you have the opportunity to have conversations with your patients, as well as other treating providers. Medical oncologists, radiation oncologists are important. Even though radiation has a very limited role with peritoneal meso, it's still an opportunity to make sure that we are, you know, considering all aspects, all options, et cetera. We also have a great team of navigators, which are nurses that really guide patients along, help them provide support services, services, nutrition, genetics, et cetera. So all of those things play a role, you know, and at the end of the day, it really is that human nature that we're all working on the same team, you know, a treatment that's going to at least offer some benefit in the long run.
Dr. Bhagwandan, thank you so much. This was insightful and enlightening, and I hope really informative. It was informative for me, and I hope it was just as informative for anyone who listens to this podcast. Yeah. Thank you, and again, thank you for being the first one. This is really special for us, and I hope that you enjoyed it.
Yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity, and I think one of the things about having a tough diagnosis is awareness. It's not only awareness for patients, but their families, as well as providers that may be treating them that may not be aware that this is a potential treatment option. And anything that we can do, and certainly, you know, Mesothelioma Guide making that effort to make sure that our patients have the best information and resources for, you know, a very rare cancer is important. So I'm happy to be a part of that, and I look forward to working together.
Absolutely. And everyone, again, Dr. Chanel Bhagwandan, the medical director for the gastrointestinal surgical oncology program at Jupiter Medical Center. And he's a faculty member at Mount Sinai in New York City as an assistant professor within the Division of Surgical Oncology. And we're very happy to have him here in Florida, because for a while it was kind of the mesothelioma specialist group was kind of contained to the Northeast and West Coast. So again, very happy to have you here. Again, thank you so much, and have a good day. Thank you everyone for listening to our inaugural episode of the Mesothelioma Guide podcast. We conducted it with Chanel Bhagwandan, the medical director for gastrointestinal surgical oncology program at Jupiter Medical Center. We appreciate his time and his expertise talking with us about peritoneal mesothelioma. And if you'd like more information about peritoneal mesothelioma or pleural mesothelioma, whether it's diagnosis, treatment, statistics, you can visit our website, www.mesotheliomaguide.com, and be on the lookout for more podcasts where we talk about mesothelioma with specialists, surgeons, researchers, survivors. We'd love to talk with more people, different types of people, variety of backgrounds, to give our audience a fresh perspective on handling and managing and living with this disease.